Everyone has a story to tell. What's yours? You're listening to Around the World with Dan Perry. Do you enjoy hearing tales of world adventure? Would you like travel advice from those who know the road well? Maybe you want to embark on a journey of your own, and you just need a bit of motivation to get started. You'll find all of that and more on Around the World with Dan Perry.
Hello again, friends. Welcome back to the show. My wife Katie and I recorded this episode yesterday while sitting here in our friend's bedroom in the Philippines. Katie's with me now to do this introduction. And we set out to talk about Taiwan and our bike trip through it. The highs and lows. We give a lot of tips about biking through Taiwan. And we tell our story of what happened as we went around the country. But there's one subject that I just realized we forgot to mention in the actual episode. So I just wanted to briefly discuss that now before we jump into it. And I don't know if you have anything to add, Katie, but when we first got to Mazu Island, the first place that we went, we were sitting in our hotel room at night. It had just gotten dark. And all of a sudden I heard this sound in the background, and it was sounded like an ice cream truck maybe, or like a circus music. It was going like, do 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 do.
And it seemed to go on forever.
And it just, yeah.
Went on forever and ever. And we're like, what, did the whole town buy an ice cream? Like, why is everybody, sorry, a bag just fell off the shelf. That was that little boom and distracted me there. We were just wondering, what is that from? Like, is it an ice cream truck? The whole town is buying ice cream, and so he's staying here for a really long time. Like, we didn't really understand.
And at first, the sound was pretty pleasant. It was fine. But then it repeated every 30 seconds. And we're talking about, like, we could hear this for hours. And it got louder for a while, then quieter, then louder. And it just went on and on. And we ended up staying on this island for 3 nights. And every single night, I had to hear the same song for about 2 hours from the time it got dark until almost...
How did you find out what it actually was?
So what happened was... I had some guesses as to what the sound might have been because we used to live in China, and when the street sweepers go past, like spraying down the roads, yeah, they play a similar song.
Oh, I didn't even notice.
Which is kind of funny. Yeah, it's like ice cream truck music.
Huh.
As they spray water at you, it's kind of hilarious. But then once we got to Taipei, I was just talking with a friend of a friend, and he said, oh, you should check out these podcasts about Taiwan. And one of them was about the Taipei 101. I'll definitely put a link to this on the show notes. And that was a cool little introduction to the city and to the most iconic building in the city. But then the other one was about the garbage trucks.
Mm.
And so that's where we learned about this.
I see. Right.
And it turns out that basically they want the garbage trucks to be out in the open in Taiwan. And whereas in the States, the trucks... they'll roll past really early in the morning or while everybody's at work, and they try to be as inconspicuous as possible. But in Taiwan, the trucks go past and play this annoying music. And the idea is that instead of you throwing your trash into an intermediate trash bin outside on your curb, and then the garbage man picks it up and throws it in the truck, you just take out your trash directly to the truck.
Right, so and when you hear the song, then you run out of your house and you take it out.
Yeah. And so they have managed to cut down on waste in Taiwan. I mean, Taiwan's an island. They don't have a lot of places to put trash.
Mm-hmm.
And they've encouraged recycling. And they've got an interesting system. So if you're interested in this at all, you should definitely check out that podcast. And then the other song that they play, only in Taipei though, is Four Elises by Mozart. I'm really bad at my classical music.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, the garbage trucks play this song.
Okay.
So those are the two ones. But then the rest of the island, they only play the circus music, the ice cream music.
Right.
It's
pretty funny to observe this because Dan is super auditory and noises really bother you more than they bother me.
Yeah, most people.
And the garbage truck song really drove you crazy, and you'd be biking down the road, you know, you spend a couple hours a day biking, and he'd damn it, just be like, God damn it, I had that garbage truck song in my head again.
I would dream about it. It would be with me all day, every day.
Oh my God.
For weeks on end. I could not get it out of my head. It was a punishment. And no one, the thing that annoys me more than anything is that no one around even cares. Everyone who's
on
the streets.
They're able to tune it out.
Yeah, they're just like, oh yeah, there it is. And it's just completely normal. There's a guy standing on the garbage truck all day as his job, right next to the speaker that's playing the song. It's torturous.
What's pretty funny, our friend Dave said that, which is a bit harsh, but he was just saying, if it was a civilized society, he would stand up to it and say, this is enough, no more,
yeah.
No more song.
This is unacceptable. I mean, the truck comes by at 6 p.m. every night. You know it's going to be there at the same time every day. Look, we have like smartphones now, and we have alarm clocks, and you could easily rig up an app to set some sort of alarm on your phone for you personally, like when the truck is nearby. There's ways around this. You don't have to blast this music for every single person in the city to hear. And it's so loud, and the noise carries so well because it's a high-pitched noise.
Mm-hmm.
It just carries. So even if it's like 10 blocks away, you can clearly hear it. I mean, and so you really have to put up with this music if you're traveling in Taiwan for like 2 hours every single night.
Yeah.
It's awful. I'm glad they're trying to reduce their waste, by the way. That's fine. But Jesus, there's got to be a better way.
Well, you're not there anymore, so you don't need to deal with it anymore.
Yeah, luckily.
You're free.
Right. But that being said, I think even in Taiwan, but also especially in China, they're just very tolerant of repetitive noises in a way that I don't understand.
It's true. Like when you go past, when we were in Fuzhou, every single shop was playing a song like as loud as they could, and you and I couldn't even talk as we were walking down the street because the music from every shop was so loud.
And that's one thing. That's like loud dance music, and yeah, it's kind of fun, but It's a little annoying, but not terrible. But what's super annoying is when they'll record their own voice on the bullhorn and loop it. So the banana sales lady will say, bananas for sale, 10 for 5 kwai, bananas for sale, 10 for 5 kwai, bananas for sale, 10 for 5 kwai. And it just keeps going. And she's standing right next to the thing. And as you're walking up to it, you just want to take the thing and smash it. There's just no other thoughts going through your head. And it's like, why would I ever buy bananas from you, lady? You're really annoying me.
So what you're trying to say is, if you are auditorily sensitive like Dan is, you might want to limit your stay to some of these places.
Or even if you appreciate having a modicum of sanity, you might want to buy those bananas and shove them in your ears. I mean, it's almost like the only solution.
Oh, okay.
All right, so that's all that I wanted to talk about for that little tidbit that we missed. I'd be remiss if we completely left it out of this podcast. So now we're going to jump into our discussion that we recorded yesterday about the rest of our stuff in Taiwan, loud and repetitive noises notwithstanding. So let's listen to it. Well, we made it to the Philippines.
We made it to the Philippines. Here we are. A little warmer here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Our first real warm country that we've been to.
Right. It's actually not that bad.
Season-wise.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it was 31 yesterday, which translates to, what, about 88 Fahrenheit?
Yeah.
It's not too hot here, actually.
But it was cloudy yesterday.
Yeah, it's cloudy.
It was rainy. It's been rainy the last 2 days on and off, so that makes it not like we don't have the sun beating down on us. So
no, I mean, we've only been in the country like 24 hours, so
true.
Who knows? I guess there's a typhoon near here, and they're on the other side of the Philippines.
Right. Right now, we're staying with our friend, and his family is all coming here to their home for the Christmas holiday. And his sister's flight was canceled yesterday because of the typhoon, and she's coming in this afternoon.
Yeah, so it's exciting times. We're right in the thick of it here. We've got roosters crowing all around us. We've got music blasting. We've got cars driving by on the road. We're in a quiet room now in the house, so hopefully no distractions while we talk about Taiwan.
Yeah, wrap it up.
I guess we were hoping to talk about Taiwan while we were in Taiwan, so it would be literally right there, but it still is pretty fresh on our minds. We did just leave the country yesterday.
Yep. And it's hard. It's hard to make time for it sometimes when you're, you know, we had a lot of things we wanted to see and do in Taipei.
Yeah.
The last few days after we sold our bikes, we kind of did the tourist thing for a bit.
Yeah, it felt different.
When we're riding our bikes, a little bit harder to do the tourist thing because you have to spend, you know, so many hours of the day just transporting, just riding.
Right, so I guess the focus of this talk is definitely going to be on biking because that's what we did in Taiwan.
Yeah.
What did we spend? 22 days there is what I calculated.
Okay.
So a bit over 3 weeks in Taiwan. It was a little difficult. We were just talking about this before we started recording. Like, it was, we had some troubling times coming into the country. I mean,
the thing is in Japan we had drama. Like, we had things that broke down a few times, like kind of some crazy situations. In Taiwan, we didn't have that, but at the same time, there were some struggles, and I don't know if most of that was mental or physical or both, or just that we were in a funk. I'm not sure what it was, or maybe it was all of it.
Yeah, I think a little from column A, a little from column B.
Yeah.
But it started really right when we got to the country, because we left China on a boat.
Mm-hmm.
And they warned us that we'd have to stay overnight on these little islands called, on this little island called Masu.
Right.
Or Nangan.
Nangan was the island we stayed at.
Yeah, the archipelago is called Matsu. And it's these, there's probably about 5 or 6 major islands that Taiwan controls that are right off the coast of mainland China.
Mm-hmm.
So we took a short ferry ride. It took only like an hour from the mainland, and then got all stamped into Taiwan, and we were good to go, or so we thought. But now we were warned that we wouldn't catch a boat out right away into the main island of Taiwan.
Right, to Keelung.
Keelung, that's what we were looking for. And it was fine. We thought, well, we'll just stay overnight then. We'll find a good spot. And
we actually wanted to see the island a little bit too, so that was okay.
Yeah, no big deal. Check out the island. But then right away, I remember it was just like gloomy and rainy. And
right.
We just
a little
wanted
bit cold.
It was cold, and we wanted to get to this little village to look for a spot to stay. And it was extremely hilly. I mean, way more than what we experienced in Japan, really, ever.
Well, I mean, I had read that the grades on this island were steep, and that if you rent a motorbike or scooter, that you might not even want to share with somebody because the one person would have to get off the scooter.
Yeah.
Because the scooter wouldn't make it up the hill with two people on it.
Yeah, these little 100cc scooters can't even do it.
Right. So when I read that, I was like, ah, okay, it's not going to be, you know, an island that you just want to bike around totally, but.
Right. But there were no roads along the coast. It was like, just go up and over the island. And
What do you reckon those grades were? They're definitely like over 10.
Definitely over 10%. Maybe 15% even. I mean, it was really steep.
We had to get off and push for some of those hills when we went to some of the tourist attractions. It just wasn't possible.
Especially with our bikes fully loaded. Just no way.
Right. Well, once we found a place to stay, we did do a bit of touring without all the stuff. But
right. And so we found this park next to the biggest village on the island, which is, God, the village probably has a few hundred people in it at most.
Right, right.
The whole island only has a couple thousand. It's tiny. But we found a pretty nice looking park, and I thought, wow, we could camp there, but then it was all stormy, and it would be pretty miserable and cold.
The reason that the boats weren't sailing was because of the storms.
Right. So the weather was terrible. It would suck to camp there. And then we didn't know if it was legal or not. And so we thought, okay, fine, we'll just get a hotel tonight.
Yeah.
And I had been told that Taiwan is a bit more expensive than mainland China, but still pretty reasonable. And we had just been in Japan, like one of the most expensive countries on earth. And so we thought, well, compared with Japan, it's going to be super cheap here. But not really. Every hotel on the island was like at least $50 a night.
Yeah.
And so we had a bit of a sticker shock there, whereas we were finding places cheaper than that in Japan.
Right, right. Well, I think that there's two things going for us in that. Is that one, in Japan, we had impeccable weather. We had rain only one day in our 30 days there.
Right.
And maybe twice at night we got rain, which meant we just needed to air the tent out the next night. But it wasn't raining while we were biking, and the rain was small enough in the evening that it wasn't a big deal. So that's a huge change. And also the camping was so acceptable and easy there.
Yeah.
And maybe I think one of the things we didn't quite realize was it wasn't really camping season in Japan either. And in Taiwan, people were like, it's too cold to camp.
Yeah, this is a weird thing that happened throughout our time in Taiwan. Is people would tell us, it's just too cold here, why are you camping? And we're like, at night, it was dipping down to like, in Fahrenheit, like 50 degrees. I mean, it's totally
that's
fine.
Perfect. That's our ideal camping weather.
That's like shorts weather.
Yeah, we don't want to be camping when it's hot. So yeah. For us, it's like, this is perfect camping weather. What are you talking about?
Right. Yeah, people were walking all around in their winter coats and their pants and their hats.
Such
on.
Northerners.
Yeah. But so we got a hotel, and we quickly figured out that there's one boat a day from this Keelung city that comes overnight to this island, and then it returns the next day to Keelung, and it never stays on the island overnight, unless if there's an emergency. Just like the flights, there's an airport, planes would come out, land on the island for half an hour, turn around, and fly back to the main island of Taiwan.
Right.
So we were able to get advanced warning, like 24 hours notice, that, okay, tomorrow there's no boat.
Right.
And right away we were told, tomorrow there's no boat. Because the boat didn't leave from Keelung. So we had a whole extra day. Again, not a huge deal. We did find some stuff to do. There was this, the caves were like really impressive.
Yeah, those were really impressive.
They weren't really caves, not natural caves. They were blasted by the military, these giant caverns.
So the military the island itself is very hilly. And so the military would blast out these caves so that they could hide in the caves, and then if the Chinese would attack, they'd be able to just come out of the caves, and they'd be able to counterattack really quickly and be prepared for it. So there's a lot of military setup on the island.
Oh, yeah. There were military personnel everywhere. The caves were, like, amazing. I mean, you could fit a whole fleet of ships in there. And you could walk around and see it. And now it's no longer a secret that these caves existed or still exist. And you can go tour them.
It's called the Beihai Tunnel is the name of those caves.
Oh, right, Beihai Tunnel. And there is still some military, like I just said, on the island, just in case. But relations with China are much better now than they were, like, 30 years ago. So
A lot of the bases are open. Concern and riffraff right now there, but it's not what it was. Obviously.
No, there's some talk, but no one's seriously concerned. I don't think. Well, who knows? We won't get into that.
Yeah, it's hard to say.
Anyway, so we spent a whole day doing that and riding around the island. I think we explored a good portion of it, and that was pretty fun. But then we got stuck another day, and
Another day.
Yeah, I think, we ended up spending 3 nights there.
Yeah.
And when your budget between two people is, in New Taiwan dollars, is 2,000, and then it costs 1,500 just for your hotel, that doesn't leave a lot of wiggle room for other stuff.
The good thing is that the food is cheap.
Yeah, the food was really cheap. We were able to get a meal for like 100 each.
Yeah.
So we were able to make it work and actually still meet our budget, even while spending 75% of it on our hotel.
Right.
Which, actually, I guess that's an interesting broader point about the way I personally travel, and now you do too, is we tend to spend the same amount of money no matter where we go. It's just, like, you spend different amounts on different things.
Yeah, it tends to be that, you know, for example, if we're spending more money on hotels and the food is cheaper, and or if, like in Russia, we just cooked our own food. It was much cheaper just to cook our own food most nights and eat out maybe 2 to 3 times a week. Where, you know, in Taiwan, we didn't have to do that. We could easily eat out twice a day or once a day, and it wasn't a problem.
Yeah, and in China, then, even when you stay at youth hostels where backpackers are staying, they don't have kitchens. So it's almost impossible to cook your own food there if you're traveling.
Right.
So there's always, like, different countries have different things that are more expensive.
And that's one of the things I think at this point in our, what we're, like, 4 or 5 months in, is that one of the things that is just the reality of traveling when you're moving countries is each time you get to a new country, like, we tend to just get used to the exchange rate. In our my brain is like, oh, that's a cheap price. That's an expensive price. I just get used to it. And then we go to another place. Or I just kind of get used to, you know, what foods work well with, you know, adventuring and biking or hiking or, you know, what kind of things we can find for a reasonable price. And some countries have certain foods and some countries don't. And then some countries have other things that are similar that work. And you kind of just get used to it. And then you go to the next place. And then you got to kind of get adjusted to it. And those first 2 days, it's kind of like, I got to, like, figure this out again.
There's always a little bit of that. I think it's a lot less with me, actually. I mean, not to brag or anything. It's just numbers come to my head very easily. And I'm able to multiply and divide exchange rates very quickly. And it doesn't take me long to pick that up.
Well, I mean, it's just when, like, for example, when we do go food shopping. I guess that's more of what I'm getting at, is that, you know, you'll usually, like, go do something else, and I'll go food shopping, and I'll be like, okay, so, dang, vegetables are expensive here, or vegetables are cheap here, or this is expensive here, like, this is too expensive here, so we're not going to eat that here. Like, in Japan, like, we'd see peanut butter, but I was like, I am not going to spend $7 for a jar of peanut butter.
For a tiny jar.
You know? And so we had to substitute and be like, all right, what else is, and like, the jam is really cheap there.
Yeah.
And, like, other things were cheap. And so, for me, it's just, like, having to kind of figure out, like, what's going to work. It's not a big deal. It's a little deal. But it's just an adjustment.
That's true. Walking through supermarkets, you just don't know. Like, every country has their own diets. And people don't eat peanut butter in Japan. Go figure. But they eat it all the time in China.
Yeah, and I like trying new things, too. So it's kind of a fun thing. And I know the first 2 times I go to the supermarket, like, I take a long time. Because I'm just, like, looking into the aisles and seeing what the options are, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
So, and I think one thing about Taiwan that was really cool is they have so many kinds of rice. But dang, they sold it in these big bags. And I would have loved to have cooked more with rice when we were camping. But it was just too big, too heavy. And, yeah, so.
Yeah, it's definitely an issue of traveling. You can't really buy in bulk. So you're stuck buying small amounts of everything.
And that costs a little more. And we have to think about what's heavy because we're bike touring and putting everything on the backpack. And we already have more stuff than we would. If we just traveled to Taiwan for a cycle trip, we would have had a lot less stuff than our situation because we're traveling for a year.
Yeah, I guess so.
I would have left a few things behind. But
yeah, I think about this a lot with my camera. I've got a heavy camera and a few lenses, and honestly with bike touring I didn't even take as many pictures as I normally would because it's hard to motivate myself to stop and pull out the camera, get it all set up just to take one photo.
Right, it's easier to just use the cell phone at that point.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. I think if we were going to do just a long cycle tour, we'd probably just use our cell phones. Even though I love photography, it's just something I'd have to give up.
And you know, we needed your laptop because you were putting out a book.
Right.
You're putting out a book, which is not something most people who are on a cycle tour are doing. They're not in the middle of putting out a book, you know? So
I can't believe that.
I mean, let's just take a moment here and throw ourselves a bone and just say that we're badass and we're awesome. Because you're putting out a book, and I needed your laptop to do some job searching and to, you know, do cover letters and email schools. And so we both got projects. We got stuff going on. It's not, our minds aren't totally free.
And on that note, 1,000 Days Between Part 2 in Pursuit of the South American Dream is available now on Amazon. Get your copy today.
Yeah.
It's my only advertisement, guys. Come on.
So let's go back to what we were saying. We got stuck on Nangan, and that was kind of a, it's a bit of a downer. We kind of wanted to move on. We really wanted to not have to fly. But we also acknowledge and said, you know, we made the best of it. Like, I'm an eternal optimist. And I always try to look for the positive in everything that happens, because you really do have a choice. You have a choice to get, be like, man, this sucks, blah, blah, blah. Or you have a choice to be like, oh, well, that's just the way the cards are. And that's kind of how the cards were. We needed to stay there for a few days. We were trying to catch a boat. If we wanted to take a boat, we just had to wait. But we also didn't mind a bit of a rest.
Yeah, we kind of needed it at that point.
We had gone through Japan in 30 days and maybe took like 2 rest days in Japan.
Right.
And really just needed some time to sort our stuff out and do some research, to do your book stuff, for me to do some job hunting stuff, for us to just get through photos, just even just to, you know, between countries, just to give your mind a chance to clear. Get your mind clear and ready for the next adventure. I think that's helpful.
It is. Yeah, it's always good to take a couple days between countries, I think. But even on that note, with that flying thing, I think I'm not like completely stubborn about not flying.
You're not?
I don't think I am. I'm kind of, I think I'm changing my mind on this.
You're becoming more flexible?
A little bit. Because I've never liked flying until now, but I've realized that when you have an overland option, that's just always the better option. Of course
right.
It is, because you just miss everything when you're flying.
Mm-hmm.
It's just too fast. But when you're talking about a 45-minute flight in a twin-prop airplane that's flying over just the ocean,
yeah,
versus an 8-hour boat ride over choppy waves, I mean, it's kind of not a big deal to
take
the flight.
I think if we talked about this, and you don't want to... You can't beat yourself up over your decision, because you made a decision and you just got to live with it. We decided we wanted to try for the boat, so we spent 3 days trying. And then at the end, we're like, dang, it would have been cheaper to have just flown from Japan to Taiwan than to have taken the boat and the trains and the, you know, all this stuff. But then again, you know what? No, we really enjoyed that boat ride from Osaka to Shanghai, and we enjoyed stopping in China for a few days. And that's part of the journey.
Yeah.
And I think, like, even though it didn't work out for us to take the boat, it was part of the journey. It was part of the...
Yeah, absolutely.
It's part of the trip, and that's just the way it is.
And I should point out that flight and the whole airport scenario was, like, ridiculously easy. If it were always that easy, I'd probably fly more often. I mean, it's, like, we rode our bikes to the airport. It took about 10 minutes from our hotel.
Yep.
Packed them up. Got in.
Let's go backwards 1 second here, because
okay.
The day before, so we realized the third day, the boat wasn't going to go out again. So then we went up to the airport, which is like 2 kilometers from where we were staying, the village we were staying in. We go up to the airport and we're like, hey, we want to buy a plane ticket for tomorrow. And they're like, well, the plane tickets are all booked for tomorrow. There's 5 flights tomorrow and they're all booked. We're like, what?
We couldn't believe it. Yeah, were there 5 flights?
Yeah.
Yeah. She's like, oh yeah, she even said, oh, look, I'm sorry, we only have 5 flights a day. I'm like, are you kidding me? There's 2,000 people on this island. You have 5 flights, and each flight will carry 60 people. How the hell are you able to support 5 flights, and they're all full?
Yeah.
I guess just tourism is the answer.
So then she said, oh, but don't worry, we can put you on the wait list. And we're like, okay. So you go on the wait list, and she told us what number we were. She goes, you're 100 on the wait list. We're like, what? 100?
Yeah.
That's crazy. We're never going to make it out tomorrow. Then we were really depressed. Man, we should have tried flying out sooner. We're 100. And so we were trying to figure out, like, how are we going to get a hold of you? What should we do? And she said, come here tomorrow morning early. And we went back to the hotel and told them. And we thought, we'll just go there at like 10 or something and try to get one of the later flights in the day. And later that night, the hotel lady said, no, like yesterday, they got to a person who was 116 on the wait list. So you need to go first thing in the morning. The first flight's at 8. You need to be there by 7:35.
Right.
And be ready.
Which is hilarious. The flight is at 8.
we're prepared for sitting in the airport all day. I'm like, oh, I'm gonna get all this stuff done. I'm gonna read this. I'm gonna research this. I'm gonna work on this. I'm gonna take some, you know, take some notes and update my stuff. And we got there. Sure enough, we got on the first flight
right away. Yeah. So it's like, get there about half an hour early. Put our names in. We didn't even realize this. We had to put in our names again, and now we're like 150 or something like that on that day's list. I guess we just didn't understand how the standby list works.
She basically said that the people would come through, and then they'd be like, oh, forget it. Or they get on the flight the next day. They get on the wait list. So then they get out on a flight, or they do something else, and they don't show up. So a lot of people just don't show up or get on other previous flights. They must not have a system for taking them off the list if they've gotten on a flight before that.
It must be, because we were about number 150 on the flight, and there were maybe 10 people waiting to get on that flight.
Yeah.
And we were like the fifth people called up. And so it was about half an hour before the flight left, and they're like, okay, what's your name? Can you pay in cash? Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
It was like $65 each to fly, like really cheap.
Once we flew in to Taipei, we didn't have a solid biking plan other than we were going to bike down the East Coast, and we weren't sure if we're going to take the Highway 11 or the East Rift Valley Road. If we'd gone into Keelung, we could have biked along the coast down to there. And so going into Taipei, we had to bike over the mountain to get to the coast.
Right, so we should make this clear. Our original plan was to take the boat, and we'd start in the city called Keelung. But because we ended up flying, we had to fly to a different place. We had to fly to Taipei, the capital, which is pretty far from Keelung. And then we had to completely redo our plan.
It's pretty close.
Well, it's close if you look at it on a map, but there's a mountain range between the two.
It would have been out of our way to have gone from Taipei up to Keelung. So we ended up going... We ended up basically... We thought we could go... You know, looked at Google Maps, which, you know, again, Google isn't the best for everything as far as bike touring and stuff. And in Japan, we just used the walking directions. So we used the walking directions, but Google told us, you can go through Wulai. I'm like, Wulai is a hot spring town. Let's go to the hot springs. And then we'll take Highway 9 through here. Well, it turns out that road, we got all the way down there, up the hills, down the hills, up the hills, down the hills.
But mostly up the hills.
To get to Wulai. Yeah. And there's a big snack street, so we got a bunch of snacks and had an afternoon snack. We're like, okay, so we're going to bike through here and camp over here. So we started going that way. And the road just ends. There's a police station there.
Well, we biked up a huge-ass hill
for
like 45 minutes. We were getting tired, but we were getting near the top of the
hill. And it was raining.
It was raining the whole time. But then there was just a gate that said no entry. And we went in and talked to the cops, and they said, yeah, sorry, can't go through.
And so what had happened is we were using a Google walking direction like we had in Japan. But you could hike from there to Yuli, the town on the coast. But you couldn't drive or bike that way. It looked like there was a road, but it was actually a footpath, like a hiking trail. So when I zoomed in on Google, I was like, look, here's the road here. We can bike to this.
Yeah, they look the same on Google.
You know? And so when we looked at a paper map the police officer had, the road ended and didn't go through. So you need to go around back up to Beilu. And so at this point, we were like, we can't make that today. Like, we're going to have to stay in a hotel.
Well, let's clarify this. We had spent all day. I mean, we got to Taipei by like noon. We spent all afternoon biking to get to this point. And we were probably 30 or 40 kilometers from this town on the coast that we wanted to get to. So we could almost see it. We were really close.
Yeah.
But we had to turn around and backtrack almost all the way back to where we started.
Yeah.
Almost all the way back to Taipei.
It was New Taipei City,
which is just on the outskirts of Taipei.
Yeah.
I mean, crazy. We basically lost 2 days because of that.
Yeah.
We were like kind of in a bad mood. And it was raining still.
And the police officer was like, Beilu? Oh, man, that's a really dangerous road. Like, there's a lot of traffic. Like, please be careful. Like, it's really dangerous. The cars are always passing each other and, you know. So we're like, all right, we just got to do it, you know? So we...
Yeah, what other choice do we have?
We didn't have a choice that time anyways. Yeah, so we had to do it. So the next... we ended up just getting the cheapest hot springs hotel we could find in Wulai. And enjoyed that for the evening. Just got a few beers to drown our sorrows of the first day not really working out as planned. And
plus, you know, it was the most expensive hotel we had stayed in the entire trip.
Yeah. True.
Which is really saying something, considering we were just in Japan, we went through Russia, Iceland, all these countries that you think are a lot more expensive than Taiwan.
Right.
Not necessarily true.
But because we couldn't go through, we couldn't camp where we wanted to camp, because we couldn't get through that part.
Right.
So, you know what? This is the thing, is shit happens. Like, stuff happens, and you just got to be flexible with it. You know, and it's not like we're fortunate enough that it's not like we don't have some money saved up. Like, we've got enough. We're not on such a tight budget that we can't afford some of these little things. You know, like, we're fortunate enough in that way.
Well, that's true.
You know, so anyways, we enjoyed the hot springs. We had a few beers. We made the most of it. And next day we set out. And this was probably mentally the toughest day for me. I had a lot of highs and lows in this day. And as we're biking, we went back up from Wulai to Highway 9. And Highway 9 is the Beilu Highway. And that was mostly uphill most of the day.
Well, our first half of the day was biking back down.
Right.
Because we had spent the whole last day just biking uphill, almost the whole day.
Right.
And then we biked all the way back down to almost where we had started. And then the whole afternoon was just uphill once again.
Right. So it was just kind of a tough physical and mental day, I guess. And, but here's the thing. What was really beautiful about that day was whenever we saw other people, everybody, I mean, construction workers, people in their car would roll their windows down, other bikers, everybody's like, Jayo, which literally means add oil but it's kind of implied to say like, come on, or let's go. Mm-hmm. And that really motivated me. That really pushed me. That really, like, made me feel like, yeah, I got this. You know, every time somebody would cheer for me, I'd be like, you know what? I got this. And maybe a week after this day, I listened to a Joe Rogan podcast. And he said something that really resonated with me in his podcast. He said he was talking with Russell Brand. And he was saying that, you know, if you do something really physically challenging, like where you really got to push yourself, that everybody should try to have that experience, because mentally you have to push yourself as well. Mentally you've got to make a choice, and you're physically challenging yourself and mentally challenging yourself, because mentally that's the power. That's where the power lies. That's how you get through something that's hard like that. That's how you get through a day full of biking uphill. Is you've got to choose your words that you say to yourself. You've got to, like, change your mental attitude, or you've got to figure out a way to stay positive. And he said that was one of the most freeing things for him. When he was mentally and physically challenged at the same time, it frees you in a way that it just... I don't know. It's just special. I listened to him say that, and I really agreed that it does that. I agree that it makes you just feel like, yeah, you know, like I did that. And I have power over my mind.
Yeah, it is a cool feeling.
Which fuels your body to do things that are hard and difficult.
Yeah. Although, I don't know. Did you really feel that challenge that day?
It wasn't like it was something that was undoable or anything, you know? Like, I felt good. Like, I felt when I was doing it, I felt like I was strong and like I was good.
Yeah, me too.
But I think that's because of the words that I was choosing to tell myself.
Oh, okay.
You know? By the end of the day, I felt tired, but it wasn't... I felt like maybe a month of biking in Japan had already prepared myself for it.
Yeah, me too. I was tired and sore, but not nearly at, like, breakdown phase, like physical
breakdown.
But
it was, like,
breakdown.
Sort of a... It wasn't like we had just like a hill or two to go up. You know, it was kind of like a steady climb throughout the day. Like it would kind of go up, and then it would even out, and then it would go up, and then it would even out. And you know, I enjoyed it.
I think part of the challenge, though, was just that we didn't know how high we were gonna go. I mean, we're not great at planning this stuff out. I mean, it's not even really possible on such a long trip to plan every aspect of it. So a lot of these roads, we just get on it, and it's like, oh, it's going uphill.
Yeah.
Oh, I wonder when that's going to end. And it could end after 5 minutes, or it couldn't end after 5 hours.
We had to change our route that day, so we weren't planning on taking that road anyway.
No.
It was kind of a change in our route, so it wasn't planned.
And we've got a map, but we don't have a good topographical map or anything. So, I mean, that's our fault. But
And bike map is something that does work well in Taiwan, and we did end up using bike map after that to kind of see what the elevation gains were for other rides. But at that point, we weren't ready for that. We weren't prepared for that yet.
Yeah. So then we got to the top.
Well, there's a town there. I think it's called Pingling. And we kind of knew we had like this much daylight left to get to our campsite. So we did a quick stop for some kind of like a Powerade or a Gatorade drink. And we were like, all right, we got to go because we've got an hour and 20 minutes before the sun goes down. And there were about 5 campsites down the road.
And yeah, we're listed on Google.
On Google. And we had found this this really well full map of Taiwan that had all of the campsites and all these things in it. We're like, oh, there's all kinds of campsites here. So we started biking towards that, got to the first one, totally gated up. Call them, no, we're closed.
Yeah.
And so we called the next one. Nope, we're closed.
And along the way, my tire went flat, too.
So we had a flat tire. It got dark outside. And all these campsites were just closed.
Well, the tire wasn't completely flat. It was this weird thing. It lost air, and then it must have sealed itself up or something when it was down to, like, 20 PSI.
Right.
So I could still ride it a little bit.
Did you add air to it? You added air to it?
I might have.
2 kilometers. Yeah.
But I couldn't really ride on it far, and I was really hoping we could find a campsite before I actually patched it up.
Yeah.
I didn't want to have to patch it up on the side of the road at that point.
Yeah, so we got ahead to one, and you biked ahead to bike down to the river to this another campsite.
Yeah, this is like campsite number 5.
And the guy that answered the door, and he's like, I don't know, this is like brother-in-law's was in charge of the place or whatever, and which we didn't know at the time. So he ended up, you came back up, you got me, like, yeah, we can stay here. We go back down there, and it said it was 100 new NT dollars, which is
like $3.33.
Right, pretty cheap.
Per person. And it clearly stated that on the sign at the entrance of the place.
So we talked to the guy. It's a nice place, really nice campground. And he's like, yeah, okay, you guys can stay here. But it's going to be 800.
Yeah.
And Dan was like, what? Why 800? And he told him, oh, I got to turn the lights on. I got to turn the water on for you guys. Like, usually there's a big group. And
yeah, I should clarify also that now that we were back in a Chinese-speaking country, I could speak some Chinese, so I could communicate with these people.
Which was a huge help, by the way.
Yeah. But one thing with, you know, we had just spent a month in Japan, and I never felt like anyone was ripping me off in Japan. In China, I'm always battling against that. Like, this guy's charging me too much. I gotta fight him. Always. Even though the prices are a lot lower than Japan's.
Yeah. But you're expected to negotiate.
Yeah, you just have to. And here, I'm like, dude, it's dark out. It's raining. You're the 5th campsite we've tried. We've got a flat tire. Like, Jesus Christ, why do you have to charge us 4 times more than what your sign clearly says?
Right.
Like, just give us the price on your sign. Or even double what your sign says. It'd still be fine. So now they're charging us $27 to camp. To camp. To put up our tent.
Right.
This was probably a low point for me in all of Taiwan. It's like, we had just lost 2 days because of this detour thing as well.
Yeah, 3 days on the island, 2 days because of this detour, and then we got overcharged for camping. But we kind of had to. We were at his mercy because we It was dark outside. We had a flat tire, like you said, and we already tried four campsites.
And closed. It was the last campsite. I mean, there was. We looked at the map. There were some serious switchbacks coming up, so we didn't have the elevation on the map, but we could tell it was going to go downhill.
It was going to be all downhill, and with a flat tire, you just couldn't do that. Or at night, it wouldn't have been safe to have done that at night.
Even with good tires, no,
it wouldn't have been safe.
Not safe.
So we stayed there. And he let us camp underneath. It was raining again, so we camped underneath the big group picnic table area. And this is one thing that's different about the campsites in Taiwan that we weren't expecting, was that they're really pretty much set up for glamping. They had electricity. This guy had hair dryers. He had laundry. He had nice showers.
Yeah.
You know, like, he had all these options for us, right? Which we were like, wow, we get a shower, we get... You know, we can charge all of our stuff. That was huge. Like in Japan, when we were camping, like, we had to spend time every day stopping at a 7-Eleven or a grocery store trying to charge our batteries because campsites didn't have them.
Yeah. So once we started figuring this out, our mood improved drastically because we think of camping as you got a patch of grass that you put your tent on.
Right.
If you're lucky, you have a faucet and you have some water you can get. If you're really lucky, you have a bathroom.
Right.
But electricity, no, you don't have that. Hair dryers, that's out of the question. A roof over your head to stop the rain so your tent doesn't get wet?
Yeah.
That's just ridiculous. We would never expect that. But here we had all of that.
Yeah.
So it was like having a hotel almost.
Right. It was nice.
Basically.
So that was good. And, you know, the next day, this is one of those things. It's just... fun. It's funny how life works out this way, you know. Like, I was exhausted that night, you know. I was really tired, and the next day the sun comes out, and I should mention here that I am one of those people that clouds and rain, I understand that it's really important for things to grow. I understand how important rain is, but we had just had, this is like the fourth or fifth day in a row of rain or like clouds, and I'm really affected. My mood is really affected by cloudy weather. And the next day, the sun came out, and we had a downhill ride, and it was just beautiful. Riding down those hills, the switchbacks were intense and fun. And we got to the bottom, and we were at the sea. We were at the coast.
Yeah, I don't know how high up we went, but it was several hundred meters. Might have even been 1,000 meters.
It's 1,000 meters.
It was?
We looked in the bike map app afterwards.
Oh, okay. And it's 1,000?
Yeah, about that.
Right. So that's like 3,000 feet that we had biked up. And now we biked all the way back down to the coast. It was just glorious. Just rolling down.
That was
down.
Amazing. And then at the bottom, there's all these fruit stands and vegetable stands. And we walked for the old town in Tochung.
Right.
And I got a pineapple and a bunch of things, and I had to do everything in my power not to eat that whole pineapple. It was so good. I started to have one of those, like, acid stomach aches almost from eating too much fruit at one time. Yeah. Just so tasty.
You gotta be careful once you get to, like, these tropical and subtropical climates. There's just fruit everywhere. Fresh.
Well, you know, in Japan, it was so expensive, so now I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna get all this fruit, and it's delicious, you know? So that was... a nice reward that day. And we read on several biker blogs that there's a section between Tochung or Yuli, one of those two towns, that a lot of bikers will take the train from there to
Hualien,
or the gorge, right? One of those two places. Just because the road, there's only one road along the coast. There's not an option. Of some side roads, and it's a lot of tunnels and a lot of all the big trucks are taking Highway 9 for that. And so you're just kind of getting stuck tunnel after tunnel. And especially since it had been raining, it would just have been pretty miserable. So we skipped that part by train, kind of hung out a little bit in Tochung, just biked around a little bit, and caught the train down to the gorge area.
Yeah, and before we came to Taiwan, I should point out, we found a guy's blog, and he gave some really good advice. He said, look, you're going to be super tempted to bike all the way around Taiwan, do a loop.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to do that. And in fact, you shouldn't even do that.
It's sort of a pilgrimage for local Taiwanese bikers that they do this. And he said, but if you're coming to Taiwan for a shorter period of time or even a longer period of time, like, there's so many amazing roads to bike on in Taiwan. Why waste your time on the crappy parts?
Yeah, so there's large sections of the country that are just shitty roads going through big cities with trucks and with tunnels, and just skip those.
Yeah.
It was really easy to skip them, to take a train.
Which is great advice, because it kind of gave us a, yeah, that's right. Why should we do that to ourselves? Like, let's just take the enjoyable roads.
Yeah.
So we did. We got to the gorge, and we were planning on biking up there, but once we started biking that day, we're like, no, like, our legs are sore. Our legs were sore from the day before, and we just said, you know, let's just go hiking instead. So we did a nice hike, about 8 kilometers, and went back, and we just kind of relaxed and took it easy a little bit, which was great. It was really nice. And I think this is one of the things, too, is that you got to listen to your body. You know, if you're stressed out at work, if you're a mom or a dad and you're just overwhelmed by things, or if you're traveling, or if you're doing anything you're doing in life, is that you've got to remember to listen to your body. And at that point, we weren't feeling it, and there's no reason why we don't have to do anything, you know, and you always have that option. And I think that's important to remember sometimes.
That's right. We're not like trying to break records or anything.
And no.
The other thing is, exercise is great for you. And everyone should exercise. And biking is a great form of exercise. It's easy on your limbs for the most part. Your joints, you're not going to break your knees like you will with running. It's great for a number of reasons. But bike touring, I mean, look, we're biking 6, 7, 8 hours a day, all day. And we get worn out. It's not just on flat ground either. It's over giant hills.
Yeah.
With a heavy load, then setting up camp we know how to do it quickly. We're good at it. Setting up camp, cooking, sleeping, breaking down camp in the morning, cooking breakfast and leaving. But that's still a couple more hours of work.
Right.
And so when you're camping and bike touring, it's a full-on, full-day thing. And you can really wear yourself out doing it. So I think we're at that point where we just needed a couple days.
You made a good point to me. Like, I know you kind of said, at this point as well, it wasn't just that my body was physically kind of feeling a little tired. Mentally, I was kind of missing home a little bit. We just got through Thanksgiving, and Christmas was coming, and, you know, I kind of feel a little pressure from family about, you know, I'm not coming home for Christmas, and I just feeling a little sad in general. And you made a good point of, you know, you said that at the beginning of the trip, you're sort of like a plateau. You're really up high, and you're excited, and everything is shiny and new, and you've got all this energy. And as time goes on, like, you kind of go down and you dip a little bit. And then before you know it, we're going to be back up there again. And we're in the midway point of our year. And it's just going to be, it's going to go by fast.
Right now, it's a little hard for us to see the end still, because it's like over 6 months from now. But in 2 months, we'll be counting down the days till we go home.
Yeah.
You know, and so we're gonna try to make the most of it. And I think the last few months, hopefully, will be another really big high. But around the holidays, it can be tough. It's tough to be away, you know. But it's hard to go home too. We went home a couple of years ago for Christmas. That was really tough on my body. I mean, just the jet lag, the lack of daylight.
Yeah.
It's hard.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things. Like, we've chosen to live this crazy life. This is our choice. And this is what we love. You know, I love how travel pushes me. It's challenging me on a daily basis. And I feel I'm not working as a teacher this year, but I'm working on different things. I'm challenged in different ways. And I really do believe that after this year, I'm going to go back to teaching with a fire in my belly, and I just have this faith that that's going to happen. But right now, I also want to be true to myself and be in the moment that this is what I've worked for. I've saved for this. I've worked for this. I've dreamed about this. And it's not all sunshines and rainbows. It's not all unicorns and leprechauns. You know, like, it's, there are tough moments. There are tough days. There are times when you miss your family and you feel sad, and that's just it. And I'm trying to be an adult and to tell you how I feel when that happens, that you don't think that I'm being crabby at you for something that you did wrong. I'm just trying to be honest about that and be real, like be realistic. And I appreciate that you're also able to, you've been through this before, and you're able to kind of say like, hey, it's gonna be all right. Like it's gonna come back up, you know. And it did, and it will. And it already is. I feel like, you know, we're already in the Philippines. My family's coming here to visit us in a few weeks, and so that'll be good.
Yeah, absolutely.
But
it's a great point. Travel's tough. I mean, like, if you ask people, if you won the lottery and didn't have to work anymore, like, what would you do? A huge amount of people would say, oh, well, I'd travel. I'd quit my job and I'd travel the world. Well, it's very achievable, actually. You think it's this hard thing that you need millions of dollars for it? No. Like, I just went through our expenses. We're not going to spend that much money this year.
Yeah.
You know, it's, again, not everyone can do it financially, but a lot of people can who don't realize that they can. But
I think people don't realize how little they need. You don't need to stay in a fancy hotel. You don't need to eat out every night. You don't need those things. And you can be pretty happy with, you know, buying food and cooking it. You can be pretty happy with camping. You can be pretty happy with a lot of things that are really simple. But that takes a little bit of work. And I think what people like, most people don't like too much change. They like to be comfortable. They get into a routine. And for us, when they think about traveling for a long time, they think about, you know, constantly changing location, constantly staying in a new place every night. But what I've done is I have routines within that kind of keep me going. So I have routines about where things go in my backpack. How I pack up and stuff. Those are all little routines. We have routines for our morning breakfast and coffee and ritual, and, you know, like, we still have that. We just don't have the routine of sleeping in the same place overnight.
Well, we kind of do because we have a tent.
Yeah.
So it's one thing that I think a lot of people overlook with carrying a tent. Like, a lot of people would think you're traveling for a year and you're carrying a tent and you're actually sleeping in it all the time.
But it gives us complete flexibility. We can stay anywhere because we have tent and we have stove.
Yeah, we're not worried about like getting stuck out in the open. But what I was saying with sleeping in the tent is it does give you that familiar environment, that when you wake up in your tent, you're always in your tent. You like, outside the tent is completely unfamiliar. You could open your door and there's like a mountain out there, or there's a river, or there's a city, whatever. Mm-hmm. But you've always got that inside, is like, it's comforting to know that you're in that kind of spot.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely. We're learning as, for me, I'm learning as you go. You know, like this has been great. So, from there we the gorge, which is beautiful, but there's so many tourist buses going in and out of there. It was pretty crazy. We had a few quiet moments, but it's just similar, you know, to how it is in China too, where you get off and on a tour bus, you go and you look at the nature, and, you know, we like to be in the nature rather than just kind of look at it. But we did find that nice hike that was, you know, the tour bus didn't go that far down, and once we set off from Tacora Gorge down to Hualien.
Right.
We kind of passed around Hualien, which is one of the bigger cities in that area, and we got on to, I believe it was 193.
One of those three-digit highways.
Yeah, we found a bunch of roads that what we had read about was trying to avoid Highway 9, and there are some side alternate roads around there, so let me just check this here. I'm pretty sure it was 193.
Yeah.
So there's a few options. You can ride down the coast road on Highway 11. That's the East Coast Road. Or you can ride down Highway 9, which goes into the East Rift Valley. 193 is the road we took. And that one really winds along the farms, and that was really beautiful as well.
Yeah, that was a great road. Highway 9 actually if you have to get on it, it's not that bad. It's there is a bike lane.
Yeah, it's very true.
It's totally doable. It's just there's a lot of traffic. It's noisy. It's great when you're biking because your bike doesn't have an engine. So if there's no other cars around, you can really hear everything around you.
And yeah.
You get really put into your environment in a way you never do in a car or on a motorcycle.
And if you're going for speed and you're just trying to like get through, then you know that's a good way to go because it is a nice option. It's got a bike lane and you're going through towns. You can stop at the 7-Elevens and everything. But I really love those windy roads. And there are probably more hills on 193.
Definitely there are, yeah.
Which is a bit harder road, but it was just beautiful. It's beautiful watching the birds and the farm fields, the rice paddies as well. That was really, really nice. So we took 193 and we stopped in Rooseway. Which is another hot spring. How do you say it?
I think it's Roy. It doesn't matter.
We stopped there, and that's another hot springs town. And also, that town is really near the Tropic of Cancer marker, which is totally the kind of thing, obscure thing that Dan loved to stop at, is, you know, little monuments like that.
Yeah, so then all of a sudden we were in the tropics, and it was so much hotter and sunnier. Not really. It is this weird thing, though, when we're biking or just traveling, when we travel, we'll go for days, weeks even, without seeing any tourists at all. There's just normal people living their lives in their villages, or maybe just no people at all.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden we get to places like that gorge or like the Tropic Marker, and there's just bus loads of tourists, just all of them pulling up. It's just like, there's no in-between. It's like nothing,
right.
And then... tourists everywhere.
Yeah.
It's a little bizarre. It's a little unsettling when you see that.
Yeah.
It makes you just want to get out.
Well, they're just buzzing around the whole island. They've got this bus to just take them to all the hot spots around the whole East Coast, right? So.
Right. And then there's like people playing loud music there, and it's just this big dance party. Like, oh, we're in the tropics now.
It was the vegetable stand or like the tourist shop. They were playing like thumping, pulsing music. It was just crazy.
Yeah, the louder the better. Draw those tourists in.
Yeah, that's right. That was a nice day, too. That was a pretty good, a decent ride. And then we cycled down to a near Fooling, I think it was. We camped. We found another campsite that what we started doing after our first two nights where we kind of just kept, we felt like we were getting bad luck after bad luck. We kind of, you know, realized like, okay, people aren't camping right now. It's the rainy season. They're just not going to be camping. So campsites aren't going to be open maybe. So we need to call ahead.
Yeah.
So,
which means I need to call ahead.
Which means you need to call ahead and you learned a few more words in Chinese and you improved your phone conversation skills, right? At least you had the context.
Yeah, I never really like talking on the phone in a foreign language. It's just so hard because you can't see the person, and it's much more difficult than talking face to face.
Yeah,
but we had to do it.
Yeah, and this one was another one of those. It was a nice campsite. It was raining again that night. We camped underneath the cooking kitchen area. Had electrical outlets and a shower and everything we needed. And that morning was actually quite cold. I remember. There's a picture of you with like your long underwear on, and you've got one pair of pants, so those needed to dry off because you were biking in the rain, and you've got your long underwear on with your like hiking boots and big woolly socks with your shorts. You've got one pair of pants, one pair of shorts over the long underwear, puffer jacket on, rain jacket over the top of that, and that bright red hat you got in Mongolia, and you looked like total backpacker fashion. It was pretty awesome.
Hey, I'm a fashionable guy. What can I say? We should just talk about camping in general, though. I think what we found over and over in Taiwan was that the campgrounds are just, they're set up for big groups. So we'd go to a campground and ask, like, how much is it? And they'd say, oh, well, if you've got 8 people, it's 800. Mm. We're like, oh, well, we only have 2 people. How much is it? Well, if you have 2 people, it's 800. And
right.
They just wouldn't come down in price. And so it's absolutely terrible if you're by yourself or if you only have a couple people. it becomes really, really expensive. You've got to pay the same amount as you'd pay for 8 people.
And what we're finding is if we rolled into a place that had a campground nearby and they had some guest houses nearby, if I check online and see how expensive the guest houses were, some of the guest houses were $900 or $1,000. So when the camping is $800 to $1,000, and one city we went to, I think it was in Tamale, up ahead from where we are now in our discussion of where we our route, the campground was $1,000 and the guest house was $1,000. So in that situation, all right, let's just stay inside then.
Yeah, why would you ever camp then? And that campground, I guess we would have had access to a bathroom, but really not much else.
It didn't even have any. It was the most expensive camp that we found, and it didn't have electricity, showers. It didn't have any of the glamping stuff that we were getting from these other campsites that were cheaper.
Yeah. So I guess
it's just a little frustrating.
It's good. Like, in summary, it's good to see that the local people enjoy camping and getting outside. They just have such a different way of looking at it. They want to drive in their car to their place, set up a giant tent that weighs like 15 pounds, fill it with their whole family, string up lights outside of it, play music all night. They want to do karaoke. This is their idea of camping.
Yeah.
And it's just a little different than what we're used to.
I also was really surprised about this because of the huge biking culture that Taiwan has. Taiwan has so many active people who are really into cycle touring. And while a lot of them want to do it pretty lightweight and aren't bringing a lot of gear, they'd rather just stay in guest houses so they don't have to carry it. There are plenty of touring people who come with camping gear and stuff as well. And it just, I guess I thought, I was expecting that it would have been set up for that a bit more. And maybe it is better in the summertime when maybe there's more options in the summer when it's, but I don't really want to bike in Taiwan in the summer when it's really hot. That doesn't seem very appealing to me. I like the temperature we're biking in.
Right. We kept reading about other people's experiences in Taiwan, and they would talk about how hot the weather was, and they'd have to get up before dawn and get out before it got too hot. And we're like, well, actually, for us, it's really comfortable all day in December.
Yeah, it's pretty good. I mean, other than a little bit of rain, but...
It rained, and we had some days where it was just raining all day. Not a hard rain, but just like
drizzle.
like a spray kind
of. And here's the thing I think also is expectations are kind of a bitch sometimes. You know, like we kind of came into Taiwan with expectations of, wow, there's going to be great cycle touring and it's really well set up for cyclists and they've got bike lanes and it's just really well done. We read all these things. There's tons of blogs in Taiwan from cyclists. There's so many blogs. And so many, you know, I took this route and take this road and these are great roads to bike down. And so I had kind of some high expectations, and I'm not going to lie, that kind of was not a good thing almost, because it kind of, the camping was a bit of a downer for us in that way.
Yeah, it was definitely a letdown.
But it's not all romantic and sunshine and rainbows, like I said. So
yeah,
just,
like we were talking
you
about.
You can't have all those high expectations and expect it's always going to go as beautifully as you imagined.
Right, so you should expect the worst.
Yeah, that's right.
What do they say, like, prepare for the worst and hope for the best? No, you should hope for the worst. Because if you hope for the worst and you get anything better than that, then you've won.
So happy.
I mean, we had really low expectations for Russia, and look, we were totally happy there. It was awesome.
Yeah, it was awesome.
And if you look at it just one-to-one perspective, with the stuff we like to do, probably Russia and Taiwan were on equal footing.
Right.
If you just look at it objectively, but because our expectations for Russia were so low and our expectations for Taiwan were so high, we actually enjoyed Russia a lot more.
Yeah, that's right.
So, prepare for the worst and hope for the worst.
Yeah, and I'm always trying to find that balance between, you know, having hopes and dreams and having a vision, but also being realistic. Like, I like to be realistic about things, and that's just... I think those expectations kind of mess with my head a little bit. But, you know, it happens to the best of us. And that's just the way it is. So that day, as we left this campground we were just talking about with, I think that one was only 500, where you had your nice backpacker fashion show. We're heading out, and I was just not feeling it that day. I was cold, and we were drinking our coffee in the morning, and I just kind of told you, it's like kind of one of those days, and if you're somebody who goes to the gym or exercises or works out, you know what I'm talking about. It's one of those days where you're like, I don't want to get up and hit the yoga mat this morning. I don't feel like going to the gym today. I didn't feel like getting on the bike that day. My body was just like, oh. It wasn't even my body. I just wanted to kind of curl up with a good book and just do nothing.
I think it was mainly based on the weather.
Yeah, it's mostly the weather.
Yeah.
It's true. So, but you know what? We hopped on those bikes anyways, and we did it. And we started biking. And then I was thinking in my mind, like, are we going too fast? Like, I haven't learned anything about Taiwan yet. I don't know anything about the Aboriginal people, the local Taiwanese people, or, like, I don't know anything about the history yet. And I was like, dang, like, I want to learn something. And just as I was kind of thinking this in my mind, as we're cycling, there's a lot of conversation to have in your head when you're cycling with yourself. I was having this conversation with myself about, man, we need to slow down and, like, learn something and go to a museum or something. And there's a sign that says, like, ah, museum. And so we pulled over and we stopped to kind of look on the map. And just as that happened, this guy pulls up on his scooter. And he's like, hey, man, you guys all right? Are you okay? And we're like, oh, yeah, we're fine. We're just looking on the map for, you know, the museum that we saw the sign for. And he's like, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And this guy, man, sometimes people just come into your life at the right time. And this was one of those situations. He was a talker. And he had some noodles that were cooking. And he was just running a quick errand. But he just kept talking and basically told us, are you guys planning to stay in this town? We're like, nah, we're just biking through. He's like, well, you should plan to stay in this town, but this is a cool little town. And we didn't just stay one night. We stayed two nights, and that was a really nice weekend.
Yeah, and this guy, because he didn't mention his name, happened to be David Shand, who I just did a podcast with, the previous podcast. I think it was number 67. I'll put up a link to it.
Yeah, that was a good podcast as well. He's a funny, funny, funny character.
Yeah, you can get into his head really. A little bit.
Yeah, and so we ended up being stranger with this guy, but I left that town feeling like he was a friend, no longer a stranger, like he were part of his family. And we're looking for some camping, and we went to this campground to find, oh, well, all right, man, well, give us your number. We'll give you a call and get a beer later. We went looking for this campground, and we got up this campground, and it was like an abandoned milk, like a silkworm factory. Mm-hmm. Yeah, silkworm factory, right? And so we biked up there, and that was pretty cool, kind of creepy, kind of cool at the same time.
Oh, I love checking out like abandoned places and just seeing the hopes and dreams that never came to be. And I don't know, something about those old buildings with nobody in them. It's creepy, but it's so cool to walk through, and you're not really supposed to be there. And
yeah.
It's all these elements that I really enjoy.
So we talked about camping there, but we just, you know, knew for sure we couldn't just set up right then, and nobody was there. And so we went back down. We called Dave, and Dave's like, you can tell him about what Dave told you on the phone.
Oh, well, I said it on the last podcast too.
Oh, yeah.
He said, well, let's meet up. And he said, how can I lure you to my place? And he ended up saying, okay, you go down the road, you turn left, you head down this road until you see the Golden Buddha.
Yeah.
And once you see the Golden Buddha, you go to the right and you listen for the soothing music of Led Zeppelin, and that'll be emanating from my apartment.
Yeah.
And sure enough, there he was.
So he went to this guy's house, and his kids are just amazing. You know, they've got like a bunch of, you know, children's books that I love. And so we just started talking about books that we loved. And, you know, I teach kindergarten, so I know I'm knowledgeable about the children's book genre. And we barbecued and had a few beers, and it was just a really nice evening. The next day, went down to the lake and picnicked and barbecued again, and he basically said, hey, you know, you don't need to camp up there at the milkweed farm, silkworm farm, or whatever it was. You can just camp at the kid's school. We're like, really? At the kid's school? So he's like, yeah, there's a platform. So he took us over to the school, And we just camped for two nights at the kids' school.
Yeah, that was pretty awesome. We had to get out early, though, so we weren't...
Monday morning.
We weren't considered pedophiles or anything.
Right, right. Monday morning, we took down camp around 6 a.m., went out and got breakfast with Dave, said our farewells, and headed on our way. So but we did a couple cool touristy things in that town, too. Maybe we should talk about that a little
Go
bit
ahead.
About...
How Chishan. Do you pronounce
Chishan? And this is the area where they have the Mr. Brown's Coffee Bike Boulevard. People like to go rent bikes in this town and bike around the rice fields. And they like to stop their bicycles middle of the road and take a few photos.
It's a bit of a stretch to even call these bicycles. It's, I don't know what you should call them. Cars without engines?
They're like a four-person bicycle. Then they've got giant bicycles you can rent. They've got all sorts of bicycles. Even bicycles that they connect together and they pull by a golf car.
Oh, this is so, like, I mean, every culture has its weird things that I just don't get. This is like the weirdest thing I saw in Taiwan, probably.
Yeah.
About 20 tourists, all Taiwanese or possibly Chinese, go to this town. They each rent a tricycle.
The sitting tricycle.
Yeah.
They were the sitting one.
You can fit like three people on it or whatever.
No, these were the single ones.
Oh, one person ones?
Single sitting tricycles.
Okay.
They linked them together.
Yeah, they link them all together. And then rather than pedaling or anything, they have a guy with a golf cart go up, link up to the first one and pull them around like a centipede or something and go in circles. And it reminded me of that video game, actually. I think it's just called Centipede, where you try not to eat yourself. It's just,
what is the point of going on a bicycle if you're not going to ride the bicycle?
I didn't get it at all. It's just so bizarre.
Oh, it kills me, man. So that was fun. We had a good day biking around that town, though. It was beautiful. The rice harvest had already been had, but it was still, the park was beautiful. We rode on 193 for a little bit. And got to kind of check that out. We kind of decided that was the way we were going to go out of the town instead of Highway 9 again, take another windy country road. So it was a nice day.
It kind of reminded me of there's a few towns near Madison, Wisconsin, where we're from, that are these trendy, hip little artistic towns.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like Spring Green and what, I don't know.
Monroe and yeah. New Glarus and yeah.
These kind of places that... I mean, this town's probably going to be all gentrified soon. All these rich people from Taipei will own all the property, and no one will be able to afford to live there anymore. But for
yeah,
now,
Dave it's... did mention that. A lot of people are living in the big city now want to buy a place in a small town to go relax.
For now, it's still pretty chill. It's still a pretty small town, simple folks living there. It's really great. So check it out if you get a chance. Chishan.
Yep. We said goodbye to Dave and we headed out from there, and he recommended that we stop in Tamale. So we kind of skipped through what's the big town there, Taidong.
Yeah, a lot of the cities in Taiwan have Tai in their name.
It's really kind of confusing.
It's confusing
for me.
Yeah.
So we kind of biked around Taidong and went to Tamale, and as we're biking there, we were going past fruit stand after fruit stand after fruit stand of, it looked like, I was like, it's not an artichoke, and it's not a avocado, and it's not a, what the hell is that? You know, and it was the only thing the little shop was selling was this fruit. It's green, it's like a light colored green, and it's got a bunch of bumps on it, and it looks, they call it like a Buddha, like, it looks like a Buddha's head. And so Dan had done a podcast with Dave, and Dave told him all about this fruit, but he totally forgot about it. So I kept asking, like, what is this thing?
Yeah, well, I hadn't re-listened to it yet.
Oh, I see.
And it was like an hour and a half long. And so a lot of the subjects that we talked about just kind of...
You forget most of
them. Yeah, I forget a lot of the details. And then I was listening to it again, and he started talking about this thing that he called custard apples during the podcast. I'm like, wait a minute. The thing he's describing is exactly the thing we've been seeing all day.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's what those are. They're custard apples. Okay.
So as we're biking out of, Tamale, we picked up a couple, two for 75 New Taiwanese dollars. And Oh man, we stopped midday and had it for our morning snack, and it was like the most. I've never, again, like I have not spent a lot of time traveling in tropical areas. It literally tasted like an apple pie, like a buttery apple pie. It was so delicious. I had no idea what was coming when I tried that for the first time. We didn't have spoons either. So we're just kind of like scooping it up with our hand, and it's all like melting in your mouth and putty. You have to, it's very fleshy. The white, fleshy, almost like you pick off a part of the scale, the bump or the scale, and there's a piece of white flesh, fruit, meat, and you eat that, and then you spit out the seeds. And you're supposed to use a spoon and scoop it out. But the first time we got them, they didn't give us spoons. And we didn't know we were supposed to eat them with a spoon. So we just kind of made a huge mess out of our faces and our hands.
That's all right. I mean, they didn't have spoons in the Garden of Eden, right? Like, why would we need them there? It was, I couldn't believe this was a fruit that occurs in nature. Like, there's got to be some genetic engineering going on. It's so intensely sweet.
And when you're biking past the orchards and the trees, it's odd because I didn't know what it was, but they grow with like plastic and bags around them. And we found out that it's because these fruits are, they're expensive because it's often the bugs get into them, and it's hard. Once they go ripe, they go bad really quickly. And
yeah, it's not just people that like them. It's all sorts of creatures, great and small. Even the flies like them.
Yeah.
You see, flies like shit, and they like this fruit. Isn't that weird? Like, they like both ends of it. But whatever. So
getting down from Shishang to Tamale, we took 197 part of the way, and once we went through, we got stopped by a guy who was like, "Oh, you should come up here and have lunch at this Buddhist temple," and they had a free vegetarian lunch. And we went to the Buddhist temple, had lunch with those guys. That was really nice.
Way up on top of this hill.
We had to bike up another big hill.
We're tired.
You know, as I mentioned before, one of the, you know, I've kind of wrote down a couple of life lessons from bike touring. Sometimes to get to a good thing, you got to go up a big hill. You got to get to the top of something to see something beautiful, or to, in this case, it was to get a free lunch.
But you can't deny people. I mean, when you're bike touring, everyone wants to say hi, and people want to help you all the time. Because, like, yeah. no one's threatened by a guy on a bicycle.
Right.
The way they would be on a guy on a motorcycle or something.
And he was so excited. He said, "Oh, man, you should come have lunch with us. Like, they haven't seen a foreigner in months."
I think they said 4 months.
Yeah, so you should come because they're going to be so happy to see you. So we went up there, and all the workers were eating the lunch, and they were all just really friendly and really happy.
Yeah.
That we joined them, and that was really nice. And then afterwards, we went in to see the temple, and they had a macaw on a stand. Right. And just the irony of, you know, Buddhism believing that you should respect and honor all animals, and in this case, they were all vegetarian, but yet they had a bird chained to a tether, and I'm like, oh man, they really wanted me to hold it, and so I put the bird on my arm, and the bird didn't want to get off my arm, and I just was so sad. I like smiled for the picture, but in my heart I was like, oh, this
so
is so sad. Why is this bird chained up in a Buddhist temple? This doesn't make sense.
And like, I've spent a lot of time traveling in the Amazon, and those yellow and blue macaws are just everywhere. At sunset, they're just flying over you in pairs, and it's just this really majestic birds squawking and just beautiful. And I've also unfortunately seen a few of them with their wings clipped or just chained up like this one as pets, because they are beautiful and people like to keep them as pets.
Yeah. So that was a little bit sad, but it was nice to meet some of the locals and have lunch with them. And so we do recommend from Chaisheng to take 197. But you need to go over the bridge, and you have the option of going on Highway 9, or there is a bikeway that goes down to Lu Ye.
Sure.
L U Y E is how it's spelled.
Okay. This is another issue, though. that
I don't know how to pronounce it because
right, like in the mainland of China, Google isn't allowed, so we use Baidu, which is a Chinese app for maps. And so everything's in Chinese, which sounds terrible if you don't speak Chinese, until you realize, well, you can show this phone to someone and they can actually read it, even if you can't. And if mm-hmm. you just learn a few characters, you learn how to say stuff. Well, then when you're in a place where they speak Chinese, but you're not using that app, you're using Google in English, suddenly you can see how things are spelled, but you don't know how to pronounce anything. So you can't ask for directions, really.
Mm-hmm.
You can't really speak to people in the same way that you could. So it's almost a disadvantage to have English in some ways.
Yeah.
Which you wouldn't normally think about. Another thing with Taiwan that's a little frustrating, to be honest, is they don't have standardized pinyin. So in the mainland of China, probably in the 1950s, they took all of the cities, all of the sounds that you can make in Chinese,
mm-hmm.
and they said, here's how we're going to spell that sound.
Mm.
And it's all a standardized way of doing it, and they call that pinyin. And we're going to use the English letters to spell it. And then, of course, in Chinese, we're going to use the characters still. But at least we'll have a way to spell it. And so, like, zhong, that sound is always Z-H-O-N-G in China.
Right.
But then you get to Taiwan, and they never ended up doing that. So that sound could be Z-H-O-N-G, or it could be C-H-O-N-G, or it could be C-H-U-N-G.
Mm.
And so now you want to search for a town on Google, and you can't enter the characters. I guess there's probably a way to get it in Chinese, but if you only have the English version of Google Maps, you can't enter the Chinese characters, but then you also can't enter the pinyin, because there isn't one. You just have, so some of these noises that people make, you might have to guess like three different spellings before you get the right one.
Right.
And then you might search for like camping in this town or something, and it'll only list half of the campsites because the other half use the other spelling. So there's different spellings used.
Oh, right, right.
So it was an almost constant source of frustration.
You know, maybe you should just mention that in Taiwan they use traditional characters
also
versus the simplified, that Mao had the language simplified to increase illiteracy rates. Is that correct? Is that how it worked?
Yeah, right. In the 1950s, Chairman Mao wanted to improve literacy, so they had a bit. They had a contest of sorts. They said, "Here, submit your ideas." As far as I understand it, and so some people came up with like what eventually became pinyin, a standardized mm-hmm. way of spelling the characters in English. One guy came up with a brand new alphabet. He said, "Here's going to be the Chinese alphabet," and it did away with the characters, but didn't use the romanized letters either.
Mm.
But the winner ended up being simplified Chinese, which takes the traditional characters and just takes a few thousand of the more common ones and removes a bunch of strokes to make them easier. Which I thought that, like, I've only studied the simplified ones, and so I thought looking at the traditional ones would be really hard. I found it's not that bad. I kind of started to see patterns into how they've removed certain parts of some of the characters. And even though a lot of them are more complicated, like the character for love, for example, is I. And I've only ever really seen the simplified one. And it's funny that the simplified one, all they did was remove the heart from the middle of the character.
Oh.
So you take the character for love in Chinese has a heart in the middle of it.
Okay.
And in the simplified version, there's no heart.
Oh, I see.
And so now when I see it with the heart, I can still tell it's the same character. It's just got these extra strokes.
I see. Okay.
Yeah, just a little nerd little, digression.
Language.
So, you know, so actually, I was thinking that, again, this expectations thing. I expected to be frustrated that I couldn't read anything once again. But it wasn't nearly as bad as I thought. But then when you talk about the English spelling of a lot of the places, that's where I was not expecting it to be different than mainland China, and it was.
I see. Okay.
So that's where my frustration was. Yeah.
Well, that's part of learning, though. That's one of the things that I think as a learner, when you learn new things, you don't always know what part's going to be challenging.
Right.
But the challenging part is where the learning happens sometimes.
Right. But. And I don't know why they never standardized their spelling in Taiwan, like I'm guessing it's just because they don't want to be Chinese. They want to disassociate themselves with mainland Chinese. But that's my guess.
Yeah, that could be very true. There's definitely some some people in Taiwan have very different feelings about the Japanese, the Americans, the Chinese, because the country that has been taken over.
Yeah,
and
so
they just want to be themselves, you know?
Right, you were talking about this, how you're so frustrated that you didn't learn the history or anything. But then we started learning, and we're like, oh, these poor bastards. They just keep getting invaded by all these other countries.
Just want to be independent and have, you know, just be who they are. And
And even today with Han Chinese occupying most of the island, they weren't there originally either. The Hakka people were. And so they're the ones who have been really subjugated, you know?
Right.
So we did learn a few things, at least.
There's several different groups of the Aboriginal people that had been there. And, you know, first there's the Han Chinese that had come over 400, 500 years prior to 1949 when Chiang Kai-shek, how do you say his name? Can't say that either. I'm butchering everything
Chiang
I usually
Kai-shek,
do.
Chiang Kai-shek, I think.
Yeah. And before that, the Japanese were there, and the Japanese had built a lot of the road that the cross highways. There's three cross highways in Taiwan. There's the Northern Cross, the Central Cross, which goes through Taroko Gorge, and the Southern Cross. And then on the East Coast, there's the East Coast Highway, and go from Highway 9 to Highway 11. Or there's the Rift Valley. And the Rift Valley, which we took, goes between the Central Mountain and the Coastal Mountain. So as we're riding down Rift Valley, we had taken Highway 193 and then 197 out of Chaisheng through the Rift Valley. And that was, there's a couple options for crossing the Coastal Mountain. Sometimes people take, go Rift Valley part of the way, cross the Central, or the Coastal Mountain, sorry, on Highway 23 or Highway 30. So you really can, you have a couple options. You can really get part Rift Valley, part East Coast, depending on. But if you've got a lot of gear and you've got a lot of stuff like we did, it's probably a little bit difficult to cross the Coastal Mountain on Highway 30 or Highway 23, is what people had said.
Yeah, but there's almost unlimited options for where you can go. One thing, though, I should point out before I forget, we learned that we had taken the correct or easier way as far as north-south or south-north is concerned.
Right.
Because there tends to be a really strong northerly wind. So there were many times where we had the wind at our backs, and we could just feel ourselves being pushed along.
And the bikers coming the opposite direction were just huffing and puffing, you know, trying to go against the wind.
It would suck. So the much easier way to go is from north to south.
And down the east coast, and then up the west coast.
Yeah.
Which I think a lot of people like to try to get the West Coast out of the way if you're cycle touring. They try to get that out of the way first. But I think it's better to go the way we did.
It's better just to skip the West Coast altogether.
Yeah. So then we basically came to, we had to take Highway 9 out of Taimali, and we cycled down Highway 9, which was a bit of construction that day. We had up and down a couple of hills and a bunch of construction. We had to get through that. It was a bit of a dusty uphill, downhill construction, traffic kind of a day. And there's the campground right on the ocean, but they were closed for remodeling. We called ahead around lunchtime. They were closed for remodeling, so we went to this campground way up this hill. And Dan looked at the switchbacks and like, it's probably not higher than what we've done before. But we were just, we had to push our bikes up part of the way. And we got to the top, and I just was like, I hate Taiwan! Because we got to the top, and it's 800 for camping, and massive hills to get to the top. And I was just like, I hate this place! Just kind of had a low moment. And then after we got set up and realized, this is great view, you know, everything's all right. I settled down.
It was
okay. It was fine.
Extremely strong winds on the top of this hill.
Really strong winds.
No protection at all, no natural protection. So luckily, the owner of this campsite had set up wind blocking barriers, because otherwise, I think we would have gotten blown right off the mountain.
Right. So we had to camp next to these big, tall, black wind, almost like a tarp, but it had like a fiber where the wind could kind of go through it a little bit.
Yeah.
And that was a couple. We went one more camp that we used had the same barriers, because otherwise it just wouldn't work.
Yeah, that really saved us.
And, you know, that was another situation where sometimes if you want to get the great view, we had a great sea view from the top. If you want to do a great view, you got to go up some hard hills, just the way it is.
Yeah.
But I was just super frustrated once again that camping was so expensive. It's like not per person. It's just $800 for a tent.
And again, I called this guy and he said $800. I'm like, well, what if we have two people? $800.
Yeah.
What if we have four people? $800.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, he did kind of open up the campground for us, but
it's true. It's true.
It's like, really, we spent probably half an hour huffing and puffing, riding up this giant ass hill, and then only to spend like more. We got a whole apartment when we were in Mongolia, a whole apartment for less money than this, than we spent just to, yeah. for a spot to put down our tent.
Right, right.
In Taiwan. That's how expensive Taiwanese camping is. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
All right, I'll stop complaining about it.
Yeah, it's just the way it is, right? So the next day we biked a Highway 9 part uphill. We had to go a bit inland because there was no coast road from here. We were in a town called Dawes or something like that. We were near there. And we had to take Highway 9 uphill to kind of go into the center. Then we connected with Highway 199, and 199 was our favorite road in all of Taiwan. That was really beautiful, windy mountain road.
It was awesome. No traffic, and the grade was probably like 7 or 8% the whole time. So it never...
The hills were very doable.
Yeah, really not too hard to go up, and then going down, you weren't like laying on the bricks the whole way.
Right.
That kind of sucks when you put in all that effort to go up a hill, like for this campground road.
Yeah.
Ooh, that was a lot of work to get up the hill. And then the ride down wasn't even all that fun because we had to have our hands on the brakes
sharp,
the whole way.
Sharp turns.
Yeah, and, real sharp turns. So this 199 was just perfect. It's
beautiful. And, you know, we could have continued that road, 199, goes all the way across to the other side of the island. But we wanted to get to the southernmost point. And we didn't want to skip that. So we decided to take 199 to 200 to Highway 26, which worked out great. And we camped one night, or we didn't camp. We stayed in a surf hostel, which was a really nice place. And there's a bunch of surfing right there in this little inland corner, like a little corner basically of toward the southernmost point. We stayed there for a night, and then the next day we had a short ride to the southernmost point, which was nice to stop along. I'm glad we had a short ride that day to the southernmost point because we did want to stop and see some of the lookouts. And,
right. So we went down to the coast, then back up this hill, and again, these tour buses were pulling up at the top of this hill, and everybody's taking their pictures and looking out. Really great views.
Yeah.
So we were able to stop, and there's some military points up there, military bases, and then back down, and then we were able to find this little monument thing at the southernmost point of Taiwan.
And we did it. That was our goal, really. We weren't trying to cycle around the island entirely. We just wanted to make it to the southernmost point and enjoy ourselves along the way. And I think also that part of the ride, what I really enjoyed was biking through the little small villages, these Aboriginal villages.
Oh,
and
right.
They have these beautiful community murals. And you can see like kind of the values of the town through these murals of fishing and community. And it was just beautiful. They were really neat.
Yeah, the towns were really cool.
And I just love biking through villages. I just love it.
It's great. One of those villages, we stopped for a drink and these two women were there at this shop and they were both chewing betel nut. It's this like red thing that they chew and it like, it's really addictive and it gets in your gums and makes you, it looks like your gums are bleeding and then your teeth fall out and it's
And both
so
these
nasty.
Ladies just smiled at me and I almost felt guilty looking at their mouths because I was just like, whoa.
Yeah, like, oh, that's nasty.
They were just happy as could be, just sitting around, you know, hanging out.
But
simple life.
If you had to choose, like, either chewing tobacco for 20 years or chewing betel nut for 20 years and then, like, which one's going to do more damage to your mouth? I think betel nut is a lot worse.
I had seen a couple guys chewing betel nut, but this was the first time that I saw like a group of women just sitting there chewing, and their mouths were pretty roughed up. Their teeth were coming out. They didn't have all their teeth, and they weren't old. They were like 40.
Right.
They were like my age almost. They looked much older because of their betel nut habits.
Yeah, there's such a big difference in Taiwan between the big city and all the wealth and all of the industry that goes on there, and then these little towns. They're so different.
It is.
I wonder,
like being on a little island in coast. It is. It's an island, right?
It is. Yeah.
So you feel like you're in these like little tropical places, and then you get to Taipei, and it just feels so fast and so organized and so infrastructure, and I don't know.
Yeah, I always wonder when I meet people in little towns like that, like how far have they ever gone? And I sometimes ask. I mean, I've met people who have, they've never been more than 50 miles from their home.
Right, right.
Never been to the big city. And it's really interesting. Where were we? We were at the southernmost point.
Yep.
So we stayed there a couple nights.
We stayed there for two nights. They found a campground. It was only $150.
Yeah, the one
new Taiwanese dollar for each person. So $300 each.
$300 each night. For total. So this is the only campground we found in all of Taiwan where they only charge you per person.
Right.
So if it's eight people, it's $1,200. If it's two people, it's $300.
That's the only place we found.
Only one we found. Which is great. And so we ended up staying there a couple of nights.
Yeah, we just wanted to relax a little bit. We wanted to go to the Kenting National Park. We biked around a little bit, checked things out, took it easy, relaxed a little bit.
We had a quote-unquote off day off, but we still spent a good hour biking up a hill.
We still biked about 25, 30 kilometers that day.
Yes, yeah, so on our day off, we biked 30 kilometers, including one giant-ass hill.
We've said this before, is that here's the thing, is you bike somewhere, and then that bike becomes your transportation. The buses down there, we met one other foreigner, and he was saying how frustrated he was because the buses just weren't very convenient in this part of Taiwan. Like, it's pretty much set up for tour buses. Or getting there and renting a scooter. So if you haven't rented a scooter and you're not on a tour and you're trying to take public transportation, it's really inconvenient. But we had our bikes, so we had a way to get around for free.
Yeah, there's no even second thought about it. We're just going to take the bikes, no matter where we go.
Yeah.
I think definitely if you don't want to do a tour and you want to come to Taiwan, biking's by far the best way to get around.
The second best is scooter.
Yeah.
And you can't take it with you. I mean, here's the thing about the bikes as well. If you do want to take a train, you can take a bike on the train. If you have a folding bike, you can take it on any train as long as it's in a bag. And otherwise, there are certain cars available for you can roll your bike on, but you've got to buy a ticket for your bike and for yourself.
Yeah, so your price doubles. And you have to wait for the right train with the car.
Right. But it's possible at least to use it. And then when you get to the next train station, you've got transportation right away.
Right.
To get to wherever you want to go.
So if your goal is to only ride bikes and you've got a lot of time, get a good road bike or a touring bike. But if you want to do a combo of train riding and biking, a fold-up bike's a good plan.
Because then your folding bike can go on the train for free.
Yeah. Yeah, no one gave us a problem with taking our folding
bikes. And it wasn't hard finding space. There's space behind the last seat in each car, which our bikes fit in perfectly.
Yep.
That worked out really well. So after we reached the southernmost point, we relaxed for 2 days. Well, quote-unquote, relaxed for 2 days by biking around the area and going into the Kenting National Park and seeing the views from there. Really nice, beautiful sea views. We biked up to a town called Qisheng.
Qisheng.
Chung.
Chua Cheng.
I don't know how to pronounce this.
Cheng means wall, usually.
Okay. And we found a campsite there next to this hot spring district. And again, the camping was 800 New Taiwanese dollars. We 800 to camp underneath the a bit of a roof, and 400 to sleep out in the open grass. But it was going to rain, and it did rain.
Hard.
So we did pay a little extra to sleep underneath there. But this was crazy. This place is next to all these hot springs. We're going to camp there. Behind us, there's like this little community. Somebody lives in this house, and they set up a karaoke parlor on their front porch. And people were just constantly just walking past and coming, like a one-person, one-man show, some teenager. They go there. They bust out the karaoke, and I'm telling you, these people do not all sing well. And they've got it turned up so loud. We're just...
And the music is awful. It's like all these Chinese ballads. It's just terrible music. I'm sorry. It's just... Like, it's just grating on your ears.
And so we were like, we need to get out of here. Let's go to the hot springs. And so we went to a guy at the campsite two nights prior who recommended going to, it sort of was like a Japanese sento, like a public bath. And so this was the hot spring public bath. It was free. We went there. Did our hot springs, and we came back, got ready for dinner, and then next to the karaoke place is a temple, and they have this these cauldrons where they burn. They have a fire. They burn for ancestor worship, I think is what it's for. I'm not exactly sure, but they have this fire going in there, and there are people coming to the temple to pray and. It's windy. It is super, super windy. I'm not going to say it's our windiest night. We've had a few really windy nights, but it was windy. And flames like start blowing towards our tent. So our tent is just a little bit below, like there's a, behind the campground, there's a road. And it's about like 5 feet elevated from the campground wall. And there's the karaoke place behind it, or the temple next to it. And these sparks are flying in the wind. And a couple of them almost hit our tent. And poor Dan is, you know, losing his shit because our tent is our house. This is not just like a, oh, whatever, it's just a tent that would start on fire. This has been our house as we travel. So we really don't want to lose our tent.
Yeah. I mean, I just figured out about one out of three nights on our trip, we've been sleeping in our tent.
Yeah.
And... these guys just are not thinking about it. They're like lighting a giant fire during a huge windstorm. I mean, really, really strong gusts.
Yeah.
And not thinking about what might happen in that case at all. And I was so upset. I mean, even beyond the tent, they're going to burn the whole town down. I mean, luckily it had just rained, so it wasn't, like, super dry. But, Jesus, there were just sparks flying everywhere.
And this is one of those things that you always say, is that things that we think are dangerous, they don't mind. Yeah. And they're lighting fireworks off. There's a big bus that came after that. And they had the drums, and they had the costumes, and they marched up the hill to another temple or had some ceremony going on up the hill. I don't really know the custom of what the thing was behind it, but... they started lighting off fireworks right underneath the wires.
Yeah, the electric wires.
The electric wires.
They're just exploding right around the electric wires.
Okay. Which, you know.
Totally safe.
It's just funny because that's something that is similar between Taiwan and China, is that some of the things that we think are dangerous, they think are safe. Some of the things that we think, they think are dangerous.
Yeah.
Yeah, opposite.
We went.
Camping is dangerous because it's too cold.
Right. It's more extreme in the mainland, but we met someone who tried camping in a little village in the mainland, and the cops came and they said, you can't camp here, it's too dangerous. And she's got a bicycle too. Like, you got to go to the next town. And she's like, wait, it's too dangerous for me to sleep in my tent in this little sleepy little village. And now you want me to get on my bike and bike through the night on a giant highway with cars zooming past me, and that's not dangerous? Like, wait a minute here. So little things like that always come up in China. And I think we had less of that in Taiwan, but we still saw a little piece of that.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of people in Taiwan don't want to be associated with China.
Right.
Yeah. Because of the political situation. But they, a lot of people in Taiwan are Han Chinese. So they do have some common characteristics. And that's one of them that we noticed. Was like, oh, okay, this is interesting.
Right. I mean, again, I'm not an expert in this. And no, we only spent culture. A few
We're
weeks
only
there.
I don't getting know. Very surface-level culture.
Right. I don't know anything. Fine, I don't know anything. But it is a fact that a lot of the people in Taiwan, 70 years ago, their ancestors were in China.
Right.
And so they did carry a lot of the same cultural things with them, even though they've changed a lot in 70 years. But it's still there, underneath it all.
Yeah, it's true. And there are some big differences as well. Just with the way that people drive.
Also big differences.
The way with people were considerate. Like, they said to us, like, hey, is the karaoke at around 9:30? They said, like, is it too loud?
Right.
When we're getting ready for bed, that was very considerate. That wouldn't happen in the mainland.
No.
You know, and people wait for you in line. They let you, you know, line up. There are some things that are a little bit different.
Yeah.
As far as their mannerisms and their politeness and their considerations, and they're different.
But I know, the shitty thing is, I know I'm being that guy who just goes somewhere for a couple of weeks and all of a sudden I'm an expert and know all about it. But, like, so I'm acknowledging that, like, obviously I only know the bare minimum.
Right.
Within China, I mean, we lived in Beijing for 3 years, so I started to see, like, the stuff that you see at first that is just striking, like, there are many layers underneath it that you need
There's
a lot
reasons.
Of time to discover.
There's a reason. People in China had been through some very difficult decades, some very difficult things with the Cultural Revolution, and that changed the culture, that changed the social fabric, that changed their behaviors. They had to fight for things. They went through a famine. That changes a lot of things. And I think you have to acknowledge that.
And at the same time, I acknowledge that, okay, it's just a tent. Like, I know I shouldn't get mad, but, like, in that moment when there are flames flying through the air at my tent that some dickhead put out there just not thinking, I'm going to get pretty mad.
Yeah.
But
our
might...
tent survived. And
I think it did. I have to inspect it again, but...
Yeah.
Because we haven't camped again since.
That's true. And... last night camping. Next day, we biked 40 kilometers to a town called Fengliao.
Yeah.
And we caught the train there. We had been putting up posts in... Oh, I think I was in about 6 or 7 Facebook buy and sell groups throughout Taiwan, hoping that somewhere along the west coast, somebody would want to buy our bikes. And had just gotten no hits. And that day, I had been chatting with a friend, a couch-surfing friend from Madison. And she kind of said, oh, let me message this guy I know.
Like, she's from Taiwan.
She messaged the guy that she knew, and he's like, oh, I got this friend. And we connected with him, and he was in Kaohsiung. Did I say that right?
Sure. So this is another one of those. The character... that they use for the first syllable in the mainland of China would be spelled G-A-O, Gao.
Gao.
It's like a temple.
Okay.
But in when they spell it in Taiwan, it's K-A-O.
Okay.
So I think they still say it like Gao, but they just spell it with a K.
Okay.
Just because whoever came up with that spelling hundreds of years ago, that was just the sound that they heard.
Right. So we stopped there, and then this guy sold our bikes, and we sold our bikes to him, and you know, we were both sad and excited to sell the bikes and just move on, knowing that our bikes had saved us lots of money, not having to pay for transportation in Japan and Taiwan, and they had served us well for, you know, a short period of time. We bought these bikes knowing we were going to sell them again, so we didn't get top-of-the-line bikes. They did their purpose.
No, and we learned so much that I think now we have a better idea of, like, next time we do a trip like this, like, what we're going to do differently. And
yeah, and I learned that I'd want to do a trip like this again. Like, I liked bike touring. I really enjoyed it.
Right, yeah.
And I have hopes and dreams for future bike tours.
Yeah, now I'm thinking of all the other places we can go.
Yeah. Talked about New Zealand and a couple other places.
That's right.
So overall, cycling in Taiwan was less drama as far as bike issues. Only thing we had was one flat tire.
Yeah, that's all it was.
But just a bit more difficult with the campsites being open and finding places to camp. But, you know, we got a system down. We just called ahead around lunchtime and said, hey, are you guys open? Or if not, then find a guest house to kind of set our sights on for the night. And we adjusted. We adjusted to things that were different. We appreciated that campgrounds had electricity for us to charge our things. And that's all you can do, I think, when you're traveling, is that you have to realize that country's not going to change for you. You've got to change for that country. That's just the way it is. We're not going to change Taiwan camping because we don't live there.
Right.
We're, just got to take it for what it is.
That's right. You're just going through, and your job is just to observe.
But I did. I did kind of reflect upon life lessons, you know, that I learned bike touring. Life lessons that apply both to bike touring and life in general.
All right, well, let's hear it.
All right, so one of them that I already mentioned is that if you want to see the beautiful view, sometimes you have to do something hard to get there. It's same to life. If you want to accomplish something, you've got to kind of go through the hard stuff to get there. And for us, we had a lot of beautiful views, but we had to bike up some hard hills to get there, but it was totally worth it every time. And that felt good. You know, I also think that life can be hard, life can be crazy, you just gotta breathe. Like one moment at a time, take a deep breath, one thing at a time. Mantras are helpful. Like, you know, you choose the words you say to yourself. Sometimes when you're cycling uphill, you just got to choose some positive words and just keep pedaling, keep pushing it. And I think the same thing is, you know, in life, is that sometimes you just got to cheer for yourself. You got to say something positive to yourself.
I always said "Jayo" as I was biking. "Jayo, Jayo,"
well,
to myself.
Mine was "pedal, pedal," like kind of like one foot in front of the other, like "pedal, pedal, Jayo."
Oh,
that was mine.
More complicated.
A bit more complicated, but not much. And I think, like I said before, it was so beautiful. I really appreciated the culture in Taiwan of that Jayo. Like, holy cow, even the little three-year-old kid in this village was just sitting on the stoop in front of his house, and they put their arm up like they're like a trucker is going by in the U.S., when we want a big rig truck to honk his horn, we kind of do the toot toot thimble where you pull your arm down. And this little 3-year-old kid was like, "Jayo!" And he like did a little like toot toot thimble. And I realized, you know, you got to let people cheer for you. Kind of be vulnerable and tell people what your goals and your dreams are and what your passions are and what you want to accomplish. And let them cheer for you. Because that felt really good to have everybody in Taiwan on our side. It felt like everybody was like, construction worker would be like, "Yeah, you got this.
Yeah.
Go get that hill," you know? And
yeah.
It was cool.
Well, just realizing that they are cheering for you. They're not cheering against you.
Yeah. And that's probably true in life as well. Like, more people in your life are cheering for you and want to be on your side than not.
Right. It's not a zero-sum game.
It's not this You're not alone, right?
It's not this thing where if you win, someone else has to lose. Like, everybody can win.
Right. And I think another really powerful thing for me that I realized is a lot of times when you are working toward the goal is that just when you think you're almost there, you're not. And that happened a lot where I'd be biking up a hill and I'd be like, okay, we've got to be getting close. I can see the tops of the trees. So we're getting close to the top, right? And we'd be biking up a hill, and then we'd go around a turn, and I'd be like, oh, is this where the switchback down start? Nope. You go around the corner, and there's more uphill. And that happens in life all the time when you're going toward the goal. Look at your book, for example. How many times did you think, like, I'm I've almost got the Kindle version out. I've almost got it. I'm putting it in there, and then all of a sudden, some glitch, some technical issue, something else, and you have to go uphill a little bit more before you get to it.
Yeah, the 80-20 rule definitely applies with book writing. That last 20% takes at least 80% of the time.
Yeah.
And Hofstadter's Law, that's the other one, which is, of course, it always takes longer
take than... Take an account.
It always takes longer than you think it will, even after taking into account Hofstadter's Law.
Right. This is a good one. It's true. Yeah. It's very true. And I think when you think you're almost at the top and almost at your goal, you just got to keep going. That's where resilience is really important, and perseverance. Those two things, you got to have that. You got to keep going to get there, because you're almost there. This is the most critical point for that, that moment when you're almost there and you just got to push through a little bit more. But then once you get there, this is the crazy thing, is that ride down the hill is super fast. And so when you get there, you've got to celebrate and be like, hey, I got it, I did it. And you've really got to enjoy it, because it's going to go by so fast.
Yeah.
There's going to be another challenge, and you're going to get to the bottom, and it's going to feel great. And it's going to smooth out for a while. Sometimes the road smooths out, and you don't have any challenges for a while, but you have to appreciate it.
Like, imagine, you know how it sucks standing in line for a roller coaster?
Yeah.
And you stand in line for an hour, and then you get on the roller coaster, and you're like, yes, this is awesome, I'm finally here. And then 30 seconds later, you're like, oh, that was fun for 30 seconds, but now it's done. And this is like, imagine instead of just standing in line for the roller coaster, that you get there and there's like an elliptical machine, and they're like, all right, get on this for an hour. And you got to do this for an hour, then you can have your 30 seconds of roller coaster fun. And that's how biking is.
Yeah, it's true.
Well, you got to appreciate it. I almost, I didn't want the hill to go down in a hurry. It's like, all that work just to lose it all.
You know, here's the thing is, I learned this lesson through several of my own personal challenges that I've had through my surgeries. You know, when I had my cochlear implant surgery, when I had my ears turned on again, that was one thing that I decided to do for myself. That was one of the best life lessons I've ever learned is to... When you've been through a huge challenge, is to celebrate. Celebrate the small things, and you have to say, like, hey, I heard a bird today. Wow, that was cool. Like, celebrate that. Like, oh my gosh, you know, I was rock climbing, and I could hear the person down below giving me a command. That was awesome. And so, same thing with bike touring is, you know, you got to make sure that ride down is going to be quick. You got to acknowledge it. You got to appreciate it and take it in. Be in the moment, which I think is true for a lot of other things. And you know what? What goes down goes back up. It doesn't stay easy forever. Just because you've accomplished a goal doesn't mean you're going to be always getting a giant downhill like we did when we finished the Bay Yi Lu. We had giant, giant, awesome, rewarding downhill. And it doesn't always work that way. Sometimes you go downhill for a little while, and you're like, what? I've got to go back up now?
Right.
The road doesn't always smooth out. and so you've always got to be ready for a challenge in between whatever you accomplish, I think. And I think in life in general, and this applies for traveling, this applies for adventure traveling as well, a lot. Like, you know, we've done hoofers trips, we've done backpacking trips, we've done, you've got to prepare, you've got to be prepared, you've got to know, you know, safety stuff. What first aid gear do I need? What bike materials do I need? What climbing gear do I need? Like, what weather things do I need to have? You've got to be prepared. But you've got to plan for the unexpected. Shit happens, and you've got to be able to adjust to it.
Right. Yeah, I think we were really not prepared for this trip in so many ways. So I think it's what you said is really important. You do have to prepare. But if all you're doing is preparing, or if you really, really prepare thoroughly for everything, like, you're just never going to get anything done. You just never get out of bed.
But, you know, we had rain gear. We had camping gear.
Kind of.
We had cooking gear. We slept through cold nights. We were warm enough. We had bike tool. We had bike tire, you know, the first time something went wrong, we realized, oh, I'm going to check over our gear really quickly. We need to get this, this, and this. And then we got extra chain links. We got a few things, and we were more prepared. So we did learn a few things.
But the first time I got a flat tire, I was like, all right, how do I change a flat tire? I have no idea. Like, I just take it off, right? Like, just slip the tire off and then put a new one on it. And, like, I didn't realize even it's a lot harder than that. And we weren't prepared for it at all.
But we did it. We got through it.
We made it.
We learned.
Yeah, so I think that's a lesson, too. Like, you can't prepare for everything. And you don't want to be stupid. You don't want to, like, take unnecessary risks. But just realize that sometimes you got to take it in stride when bad things happen.
And you got to know that something... Be mentally prepared that something could happen.
Yeah.
You know, you got to be ready for the unexpected. And that's all I've got. Those were my takeaways. Because we had a lot of time to think. Well, on the bike, so I did a lot of thinking, which is nice. It's nice to have some time to just free your mind and really, really think about your life and really think about your challenges and think about where you want to go and appreciate the things and try to find that balance always of being in the moment and not thinking too much, but taking in the moment as well. I always struggle with that one.
Thinking but not thinking.
Yeah, thinking but not thinking. Appreciating but not getting my expectations up too high, all that stuff, right?
Yeah, that's the human condition. Reaching that meditative state is very difficult.
Yeah. But here we are. We made it through Taiwan. We had a great 22 days, and now we're ready for our adventures in the Philippines. We're taking a bit of time here now in the Philippines to reconnect with some lovely friends. Our friend Francis has taken us in and made us part of his family. We've got two more friends and their three kids driving tomorrow. We're going to celebrate Christmas together. Hopefully that'll help me miss my family a little less during the holidays until my family arrives January 23rd. So that should be good. Things to look forward to.
Sounds good. So we should wrap it up right here and get on with our night. I think we've got dinner just about ready. I feel a little bad. We haven't done any help in preparing.
Right. Well,
That's just
our friend Francis's family is... treating us as the guests of honor here, so we feel very honored to be here and very grateful to their hospitality.
Ooh, I'm gonna ask him to feed me. I'm his guest. But whatever, I'm just kidding.
All right, so let's get out there and socialize with the family.
Let's do it. Until next time.
Until next time.
Thanks once again to Katie for that interesting and ongoing discussion. And thank you, as usual, for listening. For more information about our trip and some of the places we've been, and of course, my new book, 1000 Days Between Part 2, you can always go to my website, 1000daysbetween.com. That's the number 1000daysbetween.com. Thanks once again, and I'll catch you next time.